decided that I should speak today. So it was kind of a short notice. And I guess I still tried to calculate something yesterday evening, but I didn't get very far. So this talk is kind of incomplete. It is based upon work with in progress with Michael Schmidt from Heidelberg, who is, as of a couple of years ago, emeritus, and Jan Wenning, who is not yet emeritus. He's my PhD student and applying this year for jobs, but apparently only in Europe, so for personal reasons. Anyway, so what I would like to tell you today is, you know, you don't hear very often such talks, and that is new solutions to some of our beloved equations, and one of them is Dirac. And of course, my motivation was not just like, if you want to study in classical quantum gravity, then you construct a new solution to GR, right? It is more like part of my research is baryogenesis, and so this solution is motivated by baryogenesis because it's a solution in presence of CP violation, which is crucial for baryogenesis. And I will try to explain later why that is important. But before I go to this, I will actually, since you don't have often an opportunity to hear about baryogenesis, I'll give you an overview. And there is quite a lot of material if you want to overview baryogenesis. And here I'll be quite sketchy and go fast through the material. But still, I hope you'll get a flavor of it. And so I'll first remind you of what is our standard model, and then I will move on to electroweak transition and say something about equilibrium and dynamics of it, and then how electroweak baryogenesis fits into it. And finally, I will talk about this exact solution and why this is important. Now, I'm sure that you've all of you have seen this picture. So as you know, the standard model contains fermions, namely quarks and leptons in three generations. And we know pretty well their properties, except maybe for the neutrino mass matrix. And then the interaction bosons that carry forces. And as of this year, there is also the Higgs, which seems to have been seen by LHC. Now, why is electroweak baryogenesis interesting? It's because it makes use of the Higgs sector and maybe the fermionic sector to produce baryon number. But as you're going to see, this model still seems to be incomplete from the point of view of baryogenesis. So baryogenesis wants it to be completed in some sense in order to be possible.
Yes. Model. So, you know, with a certain stretch, you can say, well, you know, I have right-handed neutrinos that are heavy, and you can get baryogenesis out of that.
Okay. That is completely true. However, there is one disadvantage of using neutrinos, and that is that we'll never be able to check it. That is the disadvantage. And well, if you can live with it, the electroweak scale baryogenesis, you can, in principle, check by let's say, within one generation. So what is important in electroweak baryogenesis is the symmetry breaking, and that happens in the hot universe. And as you know, as universe expands, it cools down, and it goes through the transition at the electroweak scale, which is about 100 GeV, whereby the symmetry SU3 color cross SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge gets broken into the symmetry as we have it at low energies. That means color plus the electromagnetism. Now, there is one number we would like to explain, and that is a number which can be, briefly, succinctly written as the ratio of baryon number density to the photon density, meaning baryon minus antibaryon number. And of course, in the current universe, the anti-baryon number is almost zero, so this is really just measuring the baryon number. And that number is actually today constrained mostly by CMB measurements. You know, you've seen all of WMAP's full sky map. And here, what you actually see, this is the anisotropy measured in the angular power spectrum versus L, which is basically the inverse scale on the sky. And this is you actually, if you go from above below, you actually decrease the amount of baryons. And as you see, the structure of the acoustic peaks actually change. And that can be used as to observe or constrain baryon number. And the constraint is pretty tight. And what came as a surprise is that this constraint actually agrees pretty well with what's been known for many, many years from these nucleosynthesis studies. So even though nucleosynthesis studies gives you much weaker constraint, but nevertheless, the two observations being completely different type of observations give us actually consistent answers. And of course, that's a good sign. That means that we are doing something well in cosmology. Consistent. Sorry?
Roughly consistent.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's nucleosynthesis has its own problems. And
so if you ignore inconsistencies, then it's consistent.
If you ignore the inconsistencies in nucleosynthesis, then the picture is consistent. Yes, that's precisely the right statement. So, so you probably all know the. A long time ago, like 45 years ago, Sakharov realized that in the early universe, you might be able to produce baryon number from starting with zero. And for this, you, of course, if you want to produce something, you need to violate that number that you want to produce, which is the first condition, B violation. Then you also need C and CP violation, otherwise processes involving baryons and antibaryons would not be equally fast. And also you need departure from equilibrium. Otherwise, the CPT theorems would tell you that in equilibrium, number of particles and antiparticles must be equal. So of course, you would like to understand how these conditions are realized through Sakharov, how Sakharov conditions are realized in the standard model. And so let me first say a few words about what happens from the equilibrium point of view. And again, I'll be very sketchy here. So if you assume that the Higgs potential has a quadratic part with a negative mass term and a quartic part which stabilizes it, then of course, this is a two H's, two compact scalar doublet. And as we know, so at low temperature, well, at low energies, the Higgs condenses to this value, 246 GeV. And if you just consider a simplified version of the Higgs potential, I can draw, for example, two dimensions, the real and imaginary part of a complex field, then you get something, some structure like this, which is like a Mexican hat type of potential. But of course, here we have a four real field, so it's like it behaves a little bit like O4, so a bit more complicated than this. Now, at high temperatures, if I perform a so-called high temperature expansion of the effective potential, then it looks like this. Mass gets corrected. For my notation, this M0 squared is minus MH squared here. So for some reason, I changed my notation. So that quantity is negative, and then you see that the high temperature gives you positive contribution to the mass. And what it means on this plot, this is my effective potential versus the field expectation value. At some very high temperatures, the potential looks like this, and the symmetry is restored. And then there is some critical temperature, Tc, in which the quadratic term drops out. You have the cubic and the quartic terms. And at the critical temperature, you have a degenerate to minima, and the cubic term is responsible for generation of a bump, if it is there. And there is also contribution to the quad coupling, which for the purposes of this talk is not very relevant. So what actually happens as the temperature cools down, you have an appearance of a second minimum degeneracy, and then the second minimum becomes lower, and then the field will tunnel from here to here, and this will generate bubbles of true phase, broken phase in the sea of symmetric phase. And so that is the first order transition. Now, if this bump or this cubic term is not pronounced enough, then what actually happens is that the bump plays no role, and the field, as soon as you arrive close to this coincidence of two minima, the field will sort of spread out, and you will basically have a second order or crossover transition. So that is basically the picture. So the important thing is that the size of this term, and the size of this term depends on the structure of the model. What are the parameters of the model and the field content of the model? And the rule of the thumb is that you want to have as many bosons as possible, because the bosons tend to increase the size of this term, E. And moreover, you want to have particles, bosonic particles, whose mass is of the order of the scale of the transition.
There is one qualification. You can have fermions contributing to the first order phase transition if their mass depends on the Higgs in the perverse way, in the sense that the Higgs web gets larger and the mass gets smaller, right? It's just, there was a paper like last week, right?
Really?
Yes. People speculate now that, you know,
I'm not aware.
This Higgs to gamma-gamma deficit, right, is related to some loops of fermionic vector-like matter, which also has couplings with the Higgs. And effectively what you need is that you make the Higgs web larger and the mass of the particle gets smaller, which is not like it's with the top. And then it's easy to imagine that this, the sign to, you know, you can play with that for the sun. So there is no theorem that it has to be, you know, like a boson. But it surely helps, of course. But
let's discuss this in private. I'm not convinced. So.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm telling you what the standard law is. Okay. Now, of course, the question is, if you now put all the parameters into the model as we know it, and that is, for example, take the standard model, and so what we know from the mid-90s, due to the work of Kayanti and collaborators, is that for Higgs mass is about 72 GeV, the transition is a crossover. And what I mean by this is if you plot, now I'm not going to plot a phase diagram, I'm just going to plot some kind of a diagram where you have the physical Higgs mass here, and here is the temperature, and basically it looks something like this. I think this is about 100 in the units of GeV. So if the universe cools down this way, then here you have if you cross this line, that's the line of first order transition. Namely, if you cross this line, then the Higgs will acquire expectation value suddenly. There will be a jump in the order parameter. And if it crosses this line, then this would be crossover. And this is about, as I said, 72 GeV. So now we know that the Higgs is about 126. And that's bad news for electroweak baryogenesis. Basically, that alone rules it out in the standard model. But of course, theories don't give up very easily. So they said, well, what about MSSM? MSSM is anyway studied for various other reasons. And Karena and collaborators have come up with this plot, which basically says that if you have a right-handed stop that is reasonably light, namely of the order 100 GeV, that can actually make the transition relatively strong, in the sense that even for the Higgs masses of the order 115 or 120 GeV, you actually can get a strong transition. The white region here is actually where the transition is strong. And I will not go into details trying to explain what these parameters are. But here, here basically means that this line is the line that divides between weak transition and strong transition. And this line here is the line that divides between the so-called color breaking phase and the usual Higgs phase. Color breaking phase is a phase where not the Higgs condenses, but some of the quarks do. And you know, it becomes colored. Anyway, Michael Schmidt was involved with this in this paper. And now this thing works provided left-handed quarks are fairly heavy, namely in the region of TV scale. From the point of view of current observations, you would say that's good news. But from the point of view of current observations, the right-handed stop light is not quite good news as far as I know. I mean, this is not yet excluded, but still it's not so pleasant. And now what you can do here, you can actually say, well, can I improve this diagram? And in fact, you can in some kind of a split Susie kind of model. Namely, you can push further the masses of light-handed quarks by orders of magnitude further. And if you do that, you can actually increase this white region somewhat by maybe 5 GV. And they're just about not enough to make it consistent with the current Higgs observation. So you get, well, give it a take to about 125 if you want to stretch it, if you take into account uncertainties. So that's pretty much not enough. So,
so just as a bulk-headed question, this really is ruled out if that thing is a Higgs 126.
Yes.
Even
so,
if you push it by
yes. So from that point of view, MSSM is dead.
Look, I mean, at that time, did they investigate all this large left-right things as well, right? I mean, it's like since Higgs came out 125, there was extensive SUSY literature that you need large left-right things, very large, right? I don't know if you've done all things like that.
Large left-right, you mean?
In the stop.
In the stop.
Right.
Why do you need that?
To boost the it's one of the solutions to boost the Higgs mass to a higher value than MSSM.
Not that as far as I know.
So it might have implications for phase transition as well. But
I don't see it can be good for.
Maybe it's not good, right?
No, I don't think they investigated that, but.
I don't think at that time, but maybe by now they already.
Maybe that one should look at it, look at back into this question. But from that point of view, you would also say, well, MSS is almost dead or dead. Is that the end of the story? And I would say, maybe not. I mean, there are ways you can extend the Higgs sector, and in literature, the ones that are considered so-called models with singlets. So you add to the usual two Higgses that you need in the, you know, for anomaly constellation in supersymmetric models, you add just one singlet, which doesn't have any symmetry. And it turns out that just this one addition of one scalar field can help a lot if you give it the right mass and the right upper couplings. And it can help by quite, these are the two examples, right? Two potential. It can help by A, quite dramatically increasing the strength of the transition, and B, also by helping dynamically. So, so much is what I wanted to say about the equilibrium aspects of the transition. Now, just one transparency now about saying something about baryon number violation. You probably all have heard of. Phalerons, and what are they is namely in the chiral sector the left fermions couple only to W fields and hypercharged gauge fields and there is the current is not fully conserved in the standard model, it's anomalous. There is the famous Adler-Velocher-Kiel anomaly. And so the anomaly is proportional to the coupling constant. This is the W field strength times its dual. And the coupling constant squared comes in because it's a more loop process. And there is also a contribution from the hypercharge field strength. And NF is the number of families. So if you believe that the standard model there are three families, that means that when you integrate this equation, what you can actually show is that this anomaly has a consequence also of baryon current violation. And so you get actually you get a structure of the vacuum of the theory that becomes complicated, namely that it has this sort of topological structure that there is a multiple minima in some kind of a potential, and there is a barrier between different minima. This barrier is set up by the Higgs field. In the absence of the Higgs excitation value, the barrier is gone, but in the presence of the Higgs excitation value, this barrier is non-perturbatively large. It's about 10 TeV. So, but if you had a way of going from one minimum to another, you would just, this one transition would actually violate, it would violate baryon number by 3 units, namely NF number of families. And the question is, can that happen? And it can happen in two different ways, namely Toft has calculated that if there is a quantum mechanical tunneling, and he estimated that due to the size of the barrier, this tunneling transition is so weak that not a single baryon would have been produced by this process in the history of the universe, at least the observable universe, right? And of course, you can say, well, a bummer. But in some sense, it's good for us, because otherwise we might be decaying, so which wouldn't be very good news for us. So baryons are so sufficiently stable, we can be built of them. And as you know, each of us has a pretty large number of them. So it's good that we are stable. But nevertheless, you know, if you start fluctuating around this minimum at very high temperatures, it's possible that high temperature fluctuation will take over that maximum and induce, therefore, transitions, not by tunneling, but simply by getting over the transition. And these are the famous Haller transitions. And let me just see what I have in the next transparency. It's nothing. So yeah, so basically what happens is that if you approach electro weak scale, this barrier is still forbiddingly high from the point of view of thermal fluctuations. So the even close to the transition, the transitions are exponentially suppressed, thermal ones. However, as you approach electro weak scale, this barrier starts dropping down, and eventually above the phase transition, the barrier is completely gone, and then the baryon and this minima they play no special role, so the field can be anywhere here in this space and start diffusing. So the rate becomes diffusion limited rather than exponentially suppressed. And of course, you can then calculate it. And Guy Moore was actually calculated this rate in the symmetric phase. So the rate is then relevant because what is that actually also tells us that at the electric transition, above the transition you have a rate is high, and below transition is exponentially suppressed, so it freezes. So during that transition, in the presence of CP violation, you can actually produce net baryon number. And that is the idea of electroweak phases, electroweak baryogenesis. Now, of course, this is... So why should we study it? And basically, the electroweak scale baryogenesis is the principal testable accelerators. So what we need for it to be successful is, as we have heard from equilibrium considerations, we need new scalar particles in the LHC. In particular, we need properties of the Higgs, but this is not the whole story. We need some additional particles. So far, they have not been seen. We need new sources of CP violation, and this can be constrained through EDM, low energy experiments, but also directly on the ILC, for example. And of course, you would like to understand the properties of the electric transition, and in the limit when this transition is very, very strong. I'm sure you've heard about this in this institute, that you could actually have gravitational wave produced at the electric transition, and that could be potentially observable, for example, by LISA, which, well, now it's questionable whether it will fly. And there is another possibility that electric phase transition could be studied through observations. I mean, this I would call this direct observation. Maybe the our only hope that we could ever see electric phase transition. There could be magnetic fields produced, and they in turn could either see galactic fields, which is fairly unlikely, or they could in turn produce gravitational waves, which also I think it's quite unlikely. So, but there is a question mark here, therefore. So the central question of barogenesis, electroweak barogenesis, is therefore not yet answered, and that is that that's the explanation for the origin of matter-antimatter symmetry lights at the TV scale that's accessible to our accelerators. And I will not talk today about leptogenesis. There will be another talk, but there is this one problem, and that is that it always involves gut scale physics. Well, at least if you try to embed Mach generation mechanism, heavy Majorana neutrinos into some gut, then it's typically gut scale physics, which is not directly accessible to experiments. So we will be always limited by some kind of indirect tests or clever theoretical arguments when studying leptogenesis. Now I will, it's about half of my talk. Any questions? No? So anyway, so now I will, I want to say a few things about the so-called charge transport mechanism. And that is, I will now begin my discussion of how you can dynamically generate baryons. So far I've talked only about equilibrium aspects. And equilibrium aspects can be used to rule in or rule out a model, but they cannot tell you anything about dynamical production. So the actual mechanism that it's believed to be most efficient goes as follows. You have, in symmetric phase, you have a thermal plasma, and here you also have thermal plasma, but here masses of particles are non-zero, while here they are zero. And as the mass particles, this wiggling curve is supposed to follow a particle which scatters in the plasma. And as particle moves close to this, this is the phase interface between the two, between Brock and the symmetric phase. If there is some CP violation here, this particle can feel the CP violation and can carry it with it in the property, for example, if it is a fermion as an axial, net axial vector current, or which is often stated in the literature, which is not strictly speaking wrong, which is the difference between left and right-handed densities in fermionic set. Now, this axial vector current, then, if it hits a sphaleron, and this is my sphaleron, it will bias the baryon number production via this sphaleron, and you will generate the net baryon number. But now, this baryon number tends, if it hits another sphaleron, might be washed out. So you'd better quickly escape into the broken phase where you're safe and you will be preserved, so where sphalerons are switched off. So that's basically the idea. But of course, this is just a sketch of what happens to one hypothetical particle. And you would want to describe this in some kind of quantitative sense. So of course, that's not so easy. This picture here is supposed to illustrate how diffusion works. And there is a diffusion going on because diffusion, as you know, involves transport. So this is like a drop of ink, and it gets diffused through process of diffusion. And of course, the equation relevant for this is the diffusion equation, whereby this is a diffusion constant. Something like this also is an equation which you have to solve here in order to understand the transport. And here, J is some kind of current. So here, you put a drop of ink. That's your current. And then it gets spread to this equation, while in here, my current is generated by this source, CP lighting source. So of course, this is all analogies, but.
Is the black region the Hubble volume, our Hubble volume?
Which black region?
That black dot with red.
It's in the side of the bubble.
Where is our part of the universe?
This picture you is can, for a brief period when the phase transition happens, right? And then the black region terminates the whole space.
At that time, there is a certain Hubble region, and this Hubble region is small in comparison to our Hubble's region.
Fine.
So it's not even 1 degree, it's much smaller on the sky.
So that black region.
So if this is Hubble region, that's the size of bubble. This bubble is much smaller than that. So you can calculate what is the size of bubble when they collide in comparison to the Hubble radius, and that's much smaller.
Okay, so what becomes our observable universe is that big circle in this picture?
No, this is just one Hubble radius at that time, and that's from today's point of view. I don't know, but this corresponds to much, much less than 1 degree, this one.
Okay.
So it's only this Hubble volume at that time. It becomes co-moving. I think it's very small. I don't know what it is.
Many of these Hubble volumes should later become
Sorry.
So
there are going to be many of these Hubble volumes.
Many of them. So,
well, that's why I'm
so the mechanism must be such.
Make our universe,
yes.
Or does one just inflate
yes.
to make our universe?
The mechanism must be such that in each volume you produce a net positive baryon number, namely positive excess of baryons with respect to antibaryons. That is,
that
and then you just average out, and that's what we see today.
Okay.
And of course, the idea here is that since this. So why this is important, I have not explained. You could also use the expansion rate of the universe to drive out equilibrium, that to satisfy the third Sakharov condition. But that one generates a two-week departure from equilibrium, namely, in dimensional units, you have something like a CP violating phase, you have H over T, and that's baryon production divided by some quantity, which is like entropy density, to be dimensionless. So, so this is too small to be to explain current baryon number.
Yeah.
So you need some process that spontaneously break translation invariance, and translation invariance is spontaneously broken here on the interface. So the state, the thickness of the interface. It's typically 10 in the units of inverse temperature.
But since we're on this subject, can I ask you, has people calculated an electric phase transition, the fluctuations of baryon number on a larger scale? So I understand that you merge very many things, that will be a collaboration and so on, but what is the typical
Is
the curvature of Mohsen baryon number?
This is all. It is happening. The scale, the relevant scale here is the scale of the size of bubbles at collision, and that scale, of course, you can diffuse a little bit bigger, but that is way too small to be observed today. So this is all much too small scales to be of any relevance for structure formation today. So the structure, the mode that participate in structure formation is way to be of any relevance.
But so one should be able to produce an estimate for the strength of the, isocurvature
mode. Yeah.
Actually,
Dominic Schwartz has done a similar study, not in the electroweak transition, which is easier. He's done it for the strong transition, which happens later, and which gives a little bit bigger scales today, and found out that they're still too small to be observable today. And so, this is, of course, it's an interesting idea, but. It does not have any relevance for structure formation, as far as I know. So anyway, so the question is, So we have this scale, which can be depending on the strength of the transition and the type of particle content. It can be anyway from a few to about maybe 50 on the T. So this is called the thick wall regime, and this is called thin wall regime. But in both of these cases, this departure from equilibrium that happens at the surface of this bubble is much, much stronger than what's induced by the expansion of the universe. So that is why we need first order transition. And of course, we've seen that you can use, for example, top, because top couples fairly strongly to the Higgs, and it can have CP violation, so you can use the top to produce axial current, and this is one possibility to produce baryon number. But this is not, it turns out that it's not the dominant way of producing baryon number in supersymmetric models. In supersymmetric models, it is actually chirginos and neutralinos, which might be important. And for those who don't know, chirginos are the partners of the charged Higgses, supersymmetric partners of the charged Higgses and Ws, while neutralinos are therefore supersymmetric partners of neutral Higgses and Z and photon. So those are fermions, and they can, in their sector, you can actually produce CP violating current, which can trickle down, you know, just like in trickle down economy, you can trickle down to the standard model sector and bias baryon production. Now the question is, of course, how do you do the calculation? And the two ways of calculating this source current that you know, this CP violating source current that is generated at this at the surface of these bubbles. And one way is the so-called gradient expansion, which gives rise to semi-classical force. And the other way is mixing of fermionic flavors. Namely, in the chirgino mass matrix, you have blocks of 2x2 chirginos. And these blocks of 2x2 can lead to flavor mixing. And that can generate a CP violation this way, and therefore source current. And so these two mechanisms are both operative and competing. And when it comes to semi-classical force, I will try to explain briefly what happens. And so what happens here is this is my Higgs. You know, Higgs goes from zero, and this is then the wall, and sort of it changes here, and it has a certain profile, of course, a certain thickness L. And you would expect that the process is more violent if the thickness decreases. And in this so-called gradient approximation, what you can actually calculate, you can calculate that energy, which is P squared plus M squared, which is actually the relation, gets modified with some kind of a pseudo gauge field. You know, this looks a little bit like the pseudo Z boson. Namely, I guess, for you who go to sometimes to condensed matter seminars, you must have heard of pseudo gauge fields, right? They also have, as derivative of something, they have sometimes introduced these pseudo fields. So this is also similar here. So you also know for electromagnetism that the zero component of the gauge field can shift energy, right? So this is a little bit like zero component of the Z field, but it's not quite like this. So you can rigorously show the following, that if you now split, you know, each fermion has 4 degrees of freedom, and you can split it into spin that is orthogonal to the bubble. So we assume the bubble is planar. So the bubble is moving through the plasma, and there is a spin projected orthogonal under this. So spin can be either positive or negative. Even though a particle is moving like this, the spin is actually not in the direction of motion of particle. It's orthogonal to the wall. So this splits your fermion into two plus two components. And the remaining two you can think of as being positive-negative frequency modes. So So this this S stands for spin, and this plus minus stands for positive negative frequency bound. And of course, the Einstein relation doesn't know anything about it, so it doesn't distinguish between spin or whether you sit on positive or negative frequency by CPT theorem. However, this force, the shift, actually does know. And you see, it's proportional to h bar. So in the limit, when h bar goes to 0, it's 0. And the reason why this must be 0, it's something to do with mixing between positive and negative frequency modes. So, and so it's also proportional to s, to spin. So it has opposite signs. So theta is the, you know, if you write fermionic masses, you know fermionic mass can be complex. So you write it as magnitude times e to the theta. And as you move across the wall, if you are in the so-called wall frame, then theta is z-dependent, spatially dependent. Or if you are in the plasma frame, then it becomes time-dependent. And so here, usually this calculation is done in the wall frame, where the plasma is moving towards you and you are sitting on the wall. Like a cowboy.
Theta prime, the derivative of theta?
Yeah, so theta prime is derivative of theta with respect to z, so that means the direction of the wall.
At the wall?
Yeah, precisely. So, and this is just m squared magnitude, and this here is the energy, E0, but this is the just the energy in the direction of motion. So this is a rigorous formula you can derive, and then you can see here that this formula actually in the if you now insert this naively into the transport equation as a force term that couples the momentum derivative in the Boltzmann equation, then you would naively calculate the force by taking minus the gradient of the energy of this energy here, and you see that this energy, this then generates force that is, acts oppositely on positive negative energy states, and it also acts oppositely on positive negative spin states. So it splits between spin plus and spin minus states. So this precisely is what you need to generate axial vector current. However, by Noether theorem, you still don't generate any vector current. And that's not surprising. And vector current you can generate only by this through this anomaly. So this term is precisely kind of a term that actually does generate such a current. And it turns out, and that is according to our work, is that this term is the dominant one typically, it's the dominant term in the MSSM biogenesis. There is also this flavor mixing, which I will not go into because I don't have that much time. So. But anyway, you can then solve this equation, and you see you have different density for spin plus and minus states. This is like Boltzmann distribution function, and also for positive and negative frequency states. And here is the collision term that you need to include to get your diffusion transport equation. So you do it in the Cherginov sector, and then you solve it, you get a source. And then you just go through the mechanism. And here is some details of how effectively this works in the Cherginov sector, what the actual mass matrix is, and how where the CP violation is. You see, CP violation is in this mixing, can be in the mixing between different species. And then this, wherever you produce in the Cherginov sector gets trickled down to the standard model via decay process of this type. And then when you calculate this, you have basically numerically solve set of transport equations. What you actually get is, this is a plot from my paper, which is now already pretty old, but anyway, for the purposes of, these are some parameters in this mass matrix of the Cherginovs, and what you actually see, there is this black region where you get enough variance. If you assume that CP violation is maximum, and also by LEP, this part of the phase space was already excluded. Now by LHC, more of this is excluded. But also by EDM experiments, it turns out that EDM experiments bite into this space, and they also tend to exclude it unless you have some fortuitous cancellations. So the conclusion of our work is also that unless you really, really push it hard, emesis and biogenesis was ruled out even before you actually, LHC started working. Now, I guess it's pretty much dead also from that point of view, even though some other works did not agree with our conclusions, and they got answer that was up to 5 times bigger than ours. But having said that, as I said, from the point of view of dynamical baryon generation and sentinel deposition, supersymmetric models with additional singlet are still alive and kicking. And here, you know, this is an example of baryon production. One is the observed value, and you know, you can see that you can produce enough baryons. Actually, 0.9 is the observed value here. Sorry. You can have enough baryons, and this is sort of going through the, you know, parameters of the model, and just to see how many models produce something that is consistent with observation. But the bottom line is that NSSM models with additional singlets are still alive, both from the point of view of of the standard deposition as well as dynamics. Now, of course, now it's up to the experimenters to push further and try to see whether any of those models are viable or not. I mean, that's we cannot do much more at this stage. So from that point of view, I guess electroweak biogenesis is still not quite not so interesting. Except I told you that so far how we know how to calculate things is we know how to calculate things in the case of now if this is your interface and it has certain thickness and it has certain velocity and so if you say that that there is a particle that has momentum p and this particle has momentum orthogonal to the motion of this wall and it has a wavelength associated with it which is one of p perpendicular, this is the wavelength basically. And this wavelength can be either bigger or can be smaller than L. And of course, so this particle here corresponds to an energetic particle, and this particle here corresponds to a very low energy particle. Now, I told you about this gradient expansion, and formally gradient expansion applied on this operator here was much less than the energy of the particle. In other words, when the effective wavelength of the particle orthogonal to the wall was much, much bigger than the size of the boundary. So if you want to be precise, then it should be h bar here as well. So what it actually means is, from quantum mechanics, I'm just performing some kind of WKB expansion. So this gradient approximation is nothing but WKB. But adapted to field theory. So, but in field theory, as I just noted, there are always particles that are long wavelength and short wavelength, and the approximation we developed apply only to short wavelength modes, and we always miss contribution for long wavelength modes. Formally, we integrate from 0 to infinity, but we always miss contribution when we calculate the axial vector current that sources baryogenesis. We always miss these guys here. And it always bothered me what happens to them. And the answer is, well, we don't know. And you cannot know unless you calculate it. And they could as well give you the dominant source because this, you know, this source is actually unsuppressed, quantum mechanically unsuppressed. So you cannot treat it in gradient expansion. And So let me tell you what actually you can actually do. So you can actually set an ansatz for kink wall. So this is the Higgs expectation model. And the kink wall can be, as I said, either in Z, or it can be, if you are in the plasma rate strain, it's a little bit like in time. So here, for simplicity, maybe we did it with time-dependent kink. So tangent hyperbolic is a function. Now, fermions are complex here. Complex, they can have a complex mass. I wanted them to a complex parameters here. And so you have actually four parameters, four real parameters in these ansatz, and the thickness of the walls. So the five parameter family ansatz. And it turns out that this has been solved in the absence of the imaginary part, in which case you don't have CP violation, by Ayala and collaborators in 94. And then they use that exact solution to study perturbatively CP violation. Some Japanese authors, Funakuba and collaborators, in the late 90s. But as far as I know, there has been no exact solution that includes CP violation, namely that includes both real and imaginary parts. And of course, you can say, well, how does imaginary real parts change? Well, you would expect if you have just the one single Higgs field that condenses, the real and imaginary parts change in time equally. And this is the assumption I make, simply because we don't know how to solve it differently. But also, it's very reasonable from the point of view of single phase addition. The real and imaginary parts change equally. Second thing is that if you solve for the time-dependent case, you can rather easily solve also for the z-dependent case, namely spatial case, where you are sitting on the wall and the plasma is moving. So it's just a mathematical trick, but the solution is almost straightforward. Now here, in the time-dependent case, you will have particle creation as a result of time dependence. In the z-dependent case, you will have reflection and transmission coefficients that you need to calculate. But from the point of view of mathematics, the calculation is equivalent. And also, there is in the time-dependent case, there is helicity conservation, while in the z-dependent case, as I've noted, there is a spin conservation. But that's about it otherwise. And this case here cannot be actually solved simply if you try to resolve the equation of positive negative frequency modes, you will find out that they actually don't decouple. And then I made the observation that if I actually remove the imaginary part of M2 by global rotation, which you can do, you can perform global fermionic rotation without any physical consequence, this positive negative frequency mode equations actually do decouple, which allowed us to solve. It was a simple, very simple trick, but it took us a while to actually realize. And as you know, this U's, they live in a two-spinor state. You have U plus and U minus H. And so each of them lives on this is like a positive on a positive frequency pole and negative frequency pole, and they talk to each other because quantum mechanically there is a coherent mixture between them, and so it is important to understand that they talk to each other. They talk to each other because these U's satisfy first order differential equations, and they link them to each other. But as I said, you can actually decouple them by rotating the imaginary part of the one of the masses. And in this case, with this scaling, you can actually get an equation for this U plus and minus that has to form a hypergeometric equation. And it's hypergeometric equation in the variable Z, which is 1/2 minus 1/2 tangent hyperbolic minus gamma T. So it's rather complicated. There is also a rescaling you need to do, Z to the alpha minus Z to the beta. Well, alpha and beta are given in terms of the frequency, the minus infinity and frequency plus infinity. Namely, this is how they are defined. So, and there are also other three parameters, A, B, C, in the differential equation. They also depend on whether on positive or negative pole. And this is the dependence. And this, as you see from here, these parameters A, B, and C in the hypergeometric equation do not actually depend on CP at all. So they are CP even functions. So you can then ask, well, where is CP violation? And that's also what bothered me for a while. But eventually I did understand that. So anyway, so you can construct two solutions in terms of for this equation now, and you can actually rigorously normalize them, and you can use first order equations to actually find out that if this is normalization of equation one, that for a plus frequency pole, that this would be normalization of minus frequency pole, and the first order equation tells you exactly how they mix. Namely, what is the relative phase between the two? You remember that only the relative phase between the two solutions is the physical one. And this relative phase is precisely actually where CP violation stands. So this is actually, you know, maybe the simplest way of writing this CP violation phase. You can actually write it here, or you can write it there, in which case the only difference would be that this minus would become plus if you write it here, since the only physical phase is actually the relative phase. And so these are the solutions in the so-called early time solutions. I call them early time because if time goes to minus infinity, they reduce to plane waves with minus I omega minus t. And you can construct two equivalent solutions which reduce to positive frequency. Well, this is what I call positive frequency solution. You can, there are two other solutions in the early time zone which have solution e to the minus I omega plus t, you know, reduced to that. And of course, you can then connect these so-called early time solutions to late time solutions by using the standard transformation for hypergeometric function. I'm sure you've seen it. Z, hypergeometric function of Z can be expressed in terms of hypergeometric function in terms of 1 minus Z. That's an exact statement. And then these two automatically will become late time solutions. Why? Because as time goes to plus infinity, 1 minus z goes e to the minus I omega plus t, it turns out. Something like this. So, at late time solutions, we actually need both of them properly normalized. And the first one is this one, and the second one is that one. You also see there are some prefactors, so it took some time, but of course, you need to make sure that they have the right limits at time goes to plus infinity. And then we need, these are the positive frequency solutions, and there are also negative frequency solutions, which we also need here, which is reduce at late times to e to the plus I omega, plus t, both of them. And so the way that these are determined is both by satisfying the hypergeometric equation, but also they have to satisfy the first order equation, and in addition, they have to satisfy the normalization condition. And you can check, it's not easy, but you can check that they do indeed satisfy the following normalization condition. And that is that when you add the plus, positive, negative frequency solution at early and late times, you have to, and square it, you have to get one for both solutions. And then these are then uniquely determined up to this one global phase. So these are our solutions, and so you can now play around with them. Namely, this condition here is also a consequence of this, is actually conservation of vector current. So if this is normalized to one, then vector current would be conserved in this case. In the Z-dependent case, it would be a different current that's conserved, actually. It's not the vector current. And now, if you have early time solution, you can actually construct the late time solution. And of course, the coefficient here, you can call them Bobolyubov coefficients, and they are, and you can calculate them, and this is what they look like. And this Bobolyubov coefficient contains some prefactors that are, don't depend on CP, but the CP violation is in the phase of these gamma functions. These are the gamma functions that you can calculate. And of course, just by looking at it, you would not see much. One thing you want to check is whether alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1. And you can check from these two that indeed it is, which is what needs to be satisfied by Bobolyubov coefficients. And moreover, what you can do, you can calculate beta squared. And beta squared is particle creation density due to the mixing between the incoming vacuum and incoming and outgoing vacuum are not the same. And due to this mismatch between the vacuum, there is a particle creation corresponding to beta squared. And this is the exact formula, and you can check that it's between 0 and 1, which is what it should be for fermions. Now you can study two different limits. Well, one thing about this is, again, there is no CP violation there. So it looks like that the CP, that the particle number generation is not the sensitive CP violation. At least it's not CP odd, that is true. But nevertheless, it is sensitive CP violation. And now, this was a complicated formula, which you can study two different limits. One is the thin wall limit, or this is still non-adiabatic, which is reducing it to step potential, which is where we actually know what it is. And this is the exact result that you can actually get. And alternatively, in the thick wall limit, where you would expect that the WKB approximation applies and the particle number is exponentially suppressed, the leading order answer is indeed exponentially suppressed. And this is the thickness of the wall, of this, of the rate of the change of the parameter. So far, so good. But there is a surprise, and that is that if you just look at the usual, you know, this is the step wall, very thin wall, moderately thin, and very thick wall. You see that, as you expect, that you produce less and less particles as you increase the thickness of the wall. But of course, also when k goes to zero, n produced is limited to be by 0.5, because that is what thermal occupancy tells you. Namely, thermal occupation number is 1 over e to the beta 8, beta omega plus 1, and this is always less than 1 half. And in the limit when temperature goes to infinity, it becomes 1 half. So you expect this to be less than 1 half, which indeed is nicely realized. But the surprise came when you actually have a CP violation in the problem, then you can get particle number anywhere between 0 and 1. So somehow CP violation induces inverse particle occupation numbers, which is, I think, nice result. And that also tells you that this treatment of CP violation, this is large CP violation, can have large effects. And this kind of effects have not been taken into account in barogenesis. Of course, this is, as I said, not CP even, so it's not CP odd, so this is all even in the CP violating phase. So this is not really of relevance for biogenesis. Nevertheless, it's an indication. What is of relevance for biogenesis is actually axial vector current. And axial vector current, just to remind you, it's an expectation value of product of psi bar gamma mu, gamma phi psi. So psi is, now if you, that's the axial vector current, and if you go to spatial momentum, you perform spatial momentum transform, then you get the phase space density of the axial vector current. And this is what we plot here. And there are two parts of axial vector current. You can plot actually CP even and CP odd parts of this current. And my CP even part is the red one, and CP odd is the blue one. And even in the vacuum, CP even current is not zero, so that's no surprise. So here you start with some non-zero value, it's constant, and the CP odd part, of course, in the vacuum is zero. So this is just a vacuum solution. And you start with the vacuum, and something funny happens. First of all, you generate both of these currents, you amplify them. This is, by the way, in the thin wall, relatively thin wall regime, and this dashed line is thickness of the wall goes to zero, and this is what you get for the wall, which is finite thickness but thin. So what you see is that that these currents get amplified and they oscillate. And the question is why on earth should they oscillate? And what happens here is the physical process of squeezing. Namely, an initial state that looks like this in some kind of phase space where you have an XP, it gets actually squeezed. So this is a Gaussian state that gets squeezed, and then, of course, as time goes on, it rotates like this, and the current is a projection of that squeeze state. So that basically explains why we have this time dependence in the current. But of course, if you average over time, you will still get zero. Nevertheless, I think it's very important. Also, this also tells you that there is no, as far as I know, Pauli exclusion principle that directly applies to this squeezing. Maybe, well, it probably is, but as you see, these currents can be pretty big. And now if you increase the thickness of this boundary, phase boundary, what actually happens, you deviate more and more from, this is the thin wall, step wall result, and you see you start deviating more and more from the step wall result, and you enter the thick wall regime. Nevertheless, for certain choice of parameters, you can still get large amplification of the current. And there's also something funny going on about the phase delay here. There's a large phase delay that you can. But what actually this this shows is that you see what I was trying to compute last evening is I was trying to compare now these results. This is a thick wall result with gradient expansion, what you get in gradient expansion. But I didn't finish my calculation, so I cannot unfortunately tell you whether this agrees or disagrees. So it will be interesting, before we finish our paper, we will have that in the paper.
Well, it should at some point, right?
It should agree, but you see, this choice of parameters is such that there is a large amplification. I did it on purpose. Not for, need relatively...
It's only a question at which gamma.
You need relatively small momenta and relatively large oscillatory masses to actually, large change in mass to actually get this large amplification. So only in the relatively infrared sector you will get such a large amplification. So I'm not sure, that this still might violate my gradient approximation condition, even though the wall is relatively thick. Anyway, so that was the end of my talk. As I said, it's still very much a work in progress, but I think that understanding this analytically, and we want to actually include the process of rescattering in some kind of a toy model, and try to see how rescattering is modified these currents. And then compare with what you get from gradient or this semi-classical force results, and whether there is a source for biogenesis that so far has been missed that is important for biogenesis. So this is the purpose of this work, which is still, as I emphasize, incomplete. But maybe I don't know whether I should go to this. Pretty much said everything what is in this blackboard. Let's now open it for questions.
So how do you see this progressing? So let's say that you do this calculation, what do you expect to get? I mean, you might get a factor of few more variance, basically. I mean,
maybe not.
But I mean, that's the worst that can happen, right? It's not going
to
be
But that's already, right? Biogenesis is at the stage where you want to make quantitative statements. You see, it's like, as I mentioned, MSSM was ruled out because of, by equilibrium consideration, because of few GeV. So there you needed two loop calculation you needed two-loop thermal calculation of the relevant two-loop diagrams to actually make the statement. Otherwise, you will not be able to make the statement. And similarly, when it comes to dynamical calculation, order of magnitude estimate is not quite enough anymore, because often you get something that is order of magnitude of the observed value. And then the question is this ruled out? Is this model ruled out based on this or not? And, well, you cannot really make the statement unless you're pretty sure that you took into account all relevant physical processes. And so here I'm talking about quantum mechanical reflection versus the gradient approximation. The gradient approximation should be this, the subdominant tail of the quantum mechanical reflection, as you know. But of course, the quantum mechanical reflection is suppressed because it's a delicate process that hugely depends on the mixing between positive and negative states. So if that mixing is perturbed by the thermal scattering or thermal plasma, so then the whole effect is gone. And just from the theoretical point of view, I think it's very interesting to understand this kind of delicate quantum mechanical effect. How much does it survive in the thermal plasma and how much is destroyed? And whether it's destroyed, we even don't know whether this is destroyed as power law or is it destroyed exponentially with temperature. So you know, there are some basic questions of purely academic interest, I think, that are of interest here. But from the point of view of biogenesis, of course, it's all going towards being able to do quantitative calculations that you can trust with a factor of few.
So let me understand. The wall thickness, usually people say it's the inverse wall thickness. It's smaller than temperature, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, the thickness, it depends on what you mean by thickness. If you mean by L,
yes.
LT is typically greater than 1. Yeah, that's
okay.
That's the statement.
So when I go to the limit of Shark wall, I should use the modes whose K is much smaller than temperature.
Not much. Well, no, I mean, you should use the mode.
For the Shark wall, I have to go with K, but it's much smaller.
This is what you have to do.
That's fast oscillation. The inverse.
This is
the
WK.
No, that's the inverse.
No, that's what
right,
WK
that's,
is.
That's a thick wall.
Yeah.
What I'm saying that you what you what
yes.
you've been solving is
exactly.
the Dirac equation for a sharp wall but a soft mode, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, your K is much smaller than inverse wall thickness.
Not much smaller. Order of magnitude
okay.
smaller.
Well,
yeah.
smaller.
Yeah, because
smaller. And then it's smaller than temperature still, right? So. Because LT is
yes.
larger.
Yes.
So in certain sense, the I don't know exact numbers, but the weight of these modes
yes.
is down by
yes.
just
sure.
a cube, right?
Sure.
Because there is
sure.
You
sure.
know
that's
that maybe soft modes, right? And,
no, well, no.
But
no,
but
no,
right,
that's not.
Maybe I have to speak for them. More than
no, that's not.
That's
right.
That's
but that's,
there is a trade-off.
That
right?
argument.
It's not that
that argument. I'm sorry, but that argument is false because you see what makes the mode soft is this K perp.
K perp.
And there is only one direction.
Okay.
So you have
but
to be careful.
It's not if argument is false. Then it's only for certain directions of the
yeah.
say all momenta are on the order of t, right? Then
yeah.
then you're solving it for very specific angles of crossing, right?
No, I have to integrate. You see?
I keep
K per fixed and I integrate over all the other ones.
Right.
So the
well,
other
well,
ones can be arbitrary.
What I'm saying is that if L, 1 over L, is parametrically smaller than temperature,
yes.
then the weight of the modes
but it's not K cubed.
As a thin wall is going to be parametrically
yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
small. That's
so
that's
no,
saying.
No. I mean, if this is LT, right, which is a small number, and this
right.
is 1, and so basically, so these are my infrared modes, and this is for which I have to do the thin wall calculation. And so the number of these modes, respect to those modes, is suppressed by basically, so the number of modes, number of infrared modes, the number, let's call them UV modes, right? It's roughly suppressed by 1 over LT. Because
that's fine, yeah.
Yeah. That's
maybe in the
budget.
Power, right?
That's precisely my point. There's
that's
no power. There's no power.
Yeah.
You could argue here that the typical energy is 3, but this is not true because this 3 is divided one T for each direction.
I got it.
So it's actually one.
What you're saying is...
So this is the suppression of this mode.
One power.
Quantum mechanical reflection typically gives you more, bigger answer than the gradient approximation. Because gradient approximation, you know, if you look at my answer, the force was gradient squared suppressed, so it goes as 1 over LT squared. So there is a suppression in the force. It goes like this. While this one, the quantum mechanical reflection doesn't have that suppression. So it could be that the quantum mechanical force reflection wins. However, this is under the assumption that the thermal bar doesn't destroy.
That's right. That was my next question.
And this
whether the tunneling, you get the phase, destroyed by the scatter. Yeah.
You know, I guess for people who are in the field, they probably the famous argument in the mid-90s, which was never resolved, which was this paper by Farrar and Shaposhnikov, and then there were some responses to it.
Well, I thought it was resolved, but...
No, it was resolved by simply making the statement that it's probably before some of your time, but it was resolved by making the statement that, well, based on thermal considerations, we know standard model is dead, full stop. And that resolved it. I mean, but the actual mechanism was never resolved.
Well, I thought there were regional papers by Gavella and all. I didn't follow the details, Shaposhnikov and Farrar were trying to use the momenta on the order of like strange quark mass, right? In the plasma that was 100 GeV, can see how many things can go wrong with that.
Yeah, and the number of those guys is suppressed, of course, the question was, and then they came up with some of the criticism, and they came up with the formalism that was actually non-unitary to actually demonstrate that this quantum mechanical delicate reflection was exponentially suppressed in the plasma. That's the statement. And in my opinion, that statement is far from being proven. So that's my humble opinion. So I don't think these papers are correct. That's what I'm trying to say. Sure, lunchtime.